Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Before we proceed with our business, I would first like to introduce a University of Wisconsin Superior Legal Studies Department students. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. You came a long way. Thank you.
You should ask them how many days they've been here.
Justice Wilcox asked, how many days have you been here? Pardon me? Good. And are you the instructor?
No, I'm the president.
Good. Thank you for coming. And we have Badger High School students. Would they please stand? Okay, they have not yet arrived, so we will recognize them when they come. And we have Iowa Grant High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you very much for coming. The high school students are with us with a special program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and State Bar of Wisconsin. And this program involves inviting high school students to come to oral argument, sending them briefs of the case that they are about to hear, and then having them meet with a justice of this court at noon to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case you are about to hear. So let me now introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler, and he is the justice with whom the classes are going to meet. Now, everybody is invited at noon. It is not limited to the students. Everybody's invited. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. Seated to my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. And before I call the first case, I would like to have a special presentation made to the court that has been requested. And if our Mr. Johnson, Scott Johnson is the District Court Administrator for the 6th and 9th Judicial District since 1999.
Good morning.
I can call you Mr. even though you're in uniform. May I?
Yes, and I will call you Chief Justice.
Wise choice.
Well, good morning again, Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the court, John and Cheryl. Thank you again for the opportunity you have provided us to be able to speak to you today. For those here that I have yet to meet, my name is Lieutenant Colonel Scott Johnson, and I'm a member of the 115th Fighter Wing, and again, I serve as a District Court Administrator for the Office of the Director of State Courts and Supreme Court. If possible, I'd like to make a few more introductions here today. Here with me is Colonel Ted Metzger, his wife, Sharon, and his sons, Paul and David.
Would they stand, please, to be recognized by the court? Thank you.
Colonel Metzger serves as the commander of the 115th Maintenance Group for the fighter wing we serve. It is truly a unique and humbling and professionally rewarding experience that allowed me to serve as his deputy commander, most recently while deployed to the 506th Air Expeditionary Group, Kirkuk Air Base, Iraq. The Army liked to call it Forward Operating Base Warrior. We did not agree with that contention. Also with me today is Colonel Mike Hinman. Colonel Hinman serves as the 115th Fighter Wing's Mission Support Group Commander. Colonel Hinman chose me to serve as his deputy commander, and I've had the distinct privilege of working with him and serving in that capacity for 3 years. Colonel Hinman was also deployed during our recent deployment cycle as the 380th Air Base Wing Mission Support Group Commander at Al Dhafra Air Base in the UAE. Although it has been somewhat routine for those of us serving in uniform to discuss deployments and numbers, it's significant to note that one half of your Madison-based 115th Fighter Wing was deployed from the spring through the fall of 2006 to the Central Command Area of Responsibility. During our most recent unit training assembly, or we know them as drill weekends, we had the opportunity to listen to four interesting briefings about the primary locations we served in. Both Colonel Hinman and Colonel Metzger provided two of those briefings to more than 100 officers assembled. They did this all knowing that they were potentially holding up a large part of this group from attending and getting to their favorite chair to watch the Super Bowl. I know them to both work well under intense pressure. First, I'd like to say that it's my privilege and honor to serve as a court administrator for the Supreme Court and Director of State Court's Office, as well as to serve in the capacity of an officer for the Wisconsin National Guard. It was a little more than 3 years ago that I stood before you to express my appreciation of your support for a deployment where we undertook preparation for combat operations in a yet unnamed operation. This operation quickly became known as Operation Iraqi Freedom after the start of combat operations in March of 2003. During the time we were transitioning to our deployment in the early winter of 2003, we, the court system, were also undergoing a transition in administrative leadership in both our director and deputy director positions. When I was notified of the pending unit deployment by my then commander, Lieutenant Colonel Janelle Kaiser, who is present with us here today with her sons, Sam, Jesse, and John.
Would Dave please rise?
I called you, Chief Justice, to provide you with the initial notification required to my employer as we were both without both a deputy director and director at that time. You provided me with the critical immediate support and encouragement that is so necessary to prepare one's family, staff, chief judges for two districts that I was covering at that time, and to ensure that no interruption for services to both districts would occur. For that support and all of the support that has followed, I'm both appreciative and grateful. Additionally, it's with the great support of all of you, both John and Cheryl, my chief judges, Jim Evenson and Dorothy Bain, our office staff, Mary Terrace, Karen Walchek, Jean Couric, as well as my colleague district court administrators, none more than Cassie Murphy and Greg Moore, that I've been able to make the transition to military service and back to civilian life, back to civilian occupation, four times in more than 5 years that have elapsed after the very tragic day on September 11, 2001. As you know, we're still fully engaged in conduct of operations Noble Eagle, which is a homeland defense mission, Enduring Freedom, which is operations in and around Afghanistan, and Operation Iraqi Freedom. Upon reflection, I remember reviewing the events that occurred the morning of September 11th in the 6th District Administrative Office on a very small portable black and white TV with one of our district administrative assistants, Karen Walchek. I'm certain we all remember what we were doing that morning. Amongst the many things we discussed in trying to understand what we were witnessing was Karen's curiosity about how this would impact me. Little did I realize that day the impact of those days' events on all of us and what has become a protracted, complex, and arduous struggle. However, today, I do understand how much this has impacted so many people beyond those who have served directly in support of combat operations. The impact is just as great, if not more so, to family and friends, their communities, and to the organizations that we citizen soldiers and airmen serve within as civilian occupations. I ask the court and those assembled continued indulgence to hear a few remarks from either Colonel Metzger or Colonel Hinman. And further, we have two short presentations that we'd like to make today. So, and I'll ask Colonel Hinman and Colonel Metzger to assist.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
All All right. First, we would like to present to John Velker and Cheryl Gervasi a certificate of appreciation from the Department of Defense and the Employer Supportive Guard and Reserve Program.
Let me read the certificate here. It says the same for both names. It's the National Committee for Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve recognizes John Velker and Cheryl Gervasi, 9th Judicial Administrative District, Supreme Court of Wisconsin, as a patriotic employer for contributing to the national security and protecting liberty and freedom by supporting employee participation in America's National Guard and Reserve Force. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Chief Justice, thank you for allowing us the opportunity to come speak about the Employer Support of Guard Reserve. It's a very important program that helps us combine with the employers that, like Scott Johnson, to share the time and the duty that calls being a military member, but we cannot do that without the support of the employers. We rely on him. He's an expeditionary airman who's deployed three times now for long periods of time, and we appreciate you suffering through his absence. In particular, he did support Colonel Metzger, and I'd like to let him speak about his deployment.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have very short remarks here, not as long as long-winded as Scotty. It's training. Chief Justice Abrahamson in the court, on behalf of the 900 airmen deployed to Kirkuk Regional Air Base in the summer of 2006, I would like to thank you for your support for Lieutenant Colonel Johnson's tour of duty there. I did not make long speeches, but if I had an entire day in this court, there would not be enough time to speak about the important work that Scott accomplished while assigned to Kirkuk. As you are well aware, Scott is a gifted and selfless individual who serves his country, the people of Wisconsin, and the state court system with distinction. As the deputy commander of the 506th Air Expeditionary Group, Scott was in charge during my absence and my most valued leadership team member. One of Scott's principal duties was to be the primary liaison between several thousand U.S. Army personnel on base in the U.S. Air Force. These two services were separated from each other 59 years ago, and as you might imagine, placing a divorced couple together after such a long separation can have its challenges. It was in this venue that Scott excelled. He reveled in the opportunity to negotiate and provide the best solution for both parties as we supported their mission there. It was through his skill and talent that our command became a successful venture. I know it was a sacrifice for you to let him go for several months. I felt the same way after he returned home and I trained a new staff for 3 weeks prior to my departure. Scott is one of the most talented officers with which I have had the privilege to serve, and I am proud to call him my friend. I thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak with you regarding his service today and for your support for the Air National Guard.
I want to thank, on behalf of the court, Colonels Metzger and Hinman and their families for coming today and honoring us by your presence and Scott Johnson by your presence and your words. We know Scott Johnson as a civilian who was an excellent administrator in our judicial system. He came to Wisconsin from the state of Oregon, where he was a trial court administrator, and also served as a court administrator in North Dakota and Minnesota. And it sounds to me as if his fine administrative qualities in the civilian life served well also in his military life, and probably learned from the military to serve in the civilian, so that he is able to serve his country and his state in both arenas. He has served, as you very well know, abroad in zones of extreme danger, along with many other men and women, and has done a very important work. The court system recognizes the obligations of all of us to fill in for someone who works in much more dangerous arenas than the 6th and 9th Judicial Districts, which seemed pretty safe to me as I have traveled them. Although all of our other district court administrators pitched in and took over without pay and using extra work weeks and days to cover for Scott Johnson, there was no complaining about that. There was only concern for his safety and the safety of all the people with whom he worked. So on behalf of the court, and indeed on behalf of the people assembled here who had the honor of being here and seeing this presentation, we say thanks to you all, thanks to Scott Johnson. We hope that there'll be peace and that none of you have to face danger again. With that, I want to the flag which you presented and the inscription will be placed in the halls where the public can see it and remember all of the work and all of the efforts of everyone in the name of freedom and peace. Thank you. Before I call the case, we have had, I believe, Badger High School students have come in. Would you please stand so we can see you all? Good. Thank you. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. I will now call State v. Jeffrey Townsend, 2003, AP 425-CR. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Townsend is Attorney Ellen Hennick.
May it please the court, my name is Ellen Hennick, and I represent the defendant, Jeffrey Townsend. Before we get to the oral argument in this case, I need to inform the court of some information that I was given but have not yet had a chance to verify by Attorney Bill Gansner this morning that may have an impact on this case. Just prior to the argument, Mr. Gansner informed me that he believes that my client may be in absconder status. I think I know what that may mean for this case. I obviously have not had a chance to research it, nor have we been able to get a hold of the parole agent to verify that information. So what I am suggesting that this court do now is that we go ahead with the oral argument with the understanding that that information will need to be checked on and that there may be a need for additional briefing on what the impact of that is on this case.
You may proceed, Ms. Hennick. This is a prize a minute in every case.
And I seem to produce them more than many.
I didn't want to say that, Ms. Hennick.
The issue in this case today is what the effect of Illinois' failure to comply with an agreement to which Wisconsin is also a signatory, the Interstate Agreement on Detainers, what the impact of that is. Now, the Interstate Agreement on Detainers is an agreement, it's also a statute, that was enacted by this state, by many of the surrounding states, and by Illinois. It was enacted to encourage the expeditious and orderly disposition of charges and to not obstruct the programs that prisoners were in. As part of that statute, in subsection 11, this state is directed to enforce the agreement and to cooperate with other parties, presumably other states, in enforcing this agreement. Now, under this agreement, what was supposed to happen and what did happen was Wisconsin notified Illinois that they wished to place a detainer on Mr. Townsend, who was in the Illinois system. Now, Illinois did not notify Mr. Townsend, and that's the finding from the circuit court, did not notify Mr. Townsend of the detainer, did not notify him of how to resolve the detainer, obviously, since it didn't notify him of the detainer, did not give him the forms, and they're known as Form I, with which to resolve the detainer. If Illinois had notified him, but given him the wrong forms, given him incomplete forms, given him forms, taken them back, and sent them perhaps to the wrong parties, and Mr. Townsend, because he'd been notified, had attempted to invoke the Interstate Agreement on Detainer, and there had been substantial compliance, and the errors were no fault of his, it's very clear that that would have been sufficient to invoke the Interstate Agreement on Detainers.
Excuse me, Counselor, just so I'm sure that I have the facts correctly, when Mr. Townsend was located in Illinois by Wisconsin authorities, he initially refused to sign a waiver of extradition. Is that correct?
No, that's actually not correct.
Okay,
the circuit court found that what had happened was, and if you look at the testimony of Inspector Layer, who was the sheriff for Cook County, he's out of Cook County Sheriff's Office, and of Public Defender Michael Pollins, who is also from Illinois, was that the policy in Cook County was that he could not waive extradition. Cook County did not allow a signing of a waiver of extradition as long as Illinois charges were pending.
But that was, unless I'm wrong about this, my understanding is at that point in time when no waiver of extradition was signed, either because he refused or, as you have explained it to me, Cook County wouldn't permit it, there hadn't been a detainer lodged by Wisconsin. So Section 3 of the IAD would not have come into effect at that point, correct?
Correct. There was an attempted extradition not through the Detainer Act at that point. What happened subsequent to that, he could not waive extradition. If you look at the record, it is not clear what he was told about who wanted him or how. The reason for that is, frankly, as the trial court put it, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, the procedures in Cook County were so confused that at this point, no one seems able to straighten out who was told what he would have been told, who would have told him.
But we're looking here at a remedy you're asking for under the IAD. And at the time, the actions that I was concerned about straightening out the facts on, they occurred prior to Wisconsin's filing the detainer under the IAD, correct?
Correct.
So at that point in time, whatever Cook County did or didn't do
correct.
Really doesn't come within the parameters of the IAD, correct?
Correct.
Okay. That's what I was confused
that's,
about.
That's
Thank
not
you.
The, what happens subsequent to that is what gives rise to this case.
Thank you.
Once Milwaukee County becomes aware, the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office becomes aware that they're not going to get extradition through Cook County. What happens is Mr. Townsend is sentenced in Illinois. What Illinois does with that is they kind of send everything back to Wisconsin at that point. Now, there's some confusion in the record about whether Wisconsin knew at that point things had been sent back to them or not. But they don't automatically lodge a detainer, nor do they do anything further with the extradition in Illinois. Subsequent to that, at some point, Wisconsin becomes aware that Mr. Townsend is now at Hill Correctional, which is located in Galesburg, Illinois. They then attempt to lodge a detainer, send it down, get notification back that, in fact, a detainer has been lodged. What should have happened at that point is that
when did that occur? Was that in 1999?
Okay. What happens, just a moment, I've got that date for you. Okay, Hill Correction, sometime right around October 4th, 1999, Milwaukee County sends a letter to Hill Correctional. We know it's received by October 7th, 1999, because at that point, personnel from Hill Correctional Institution write back and say that they've received a detainer. What should have happened at that point under their policy is that someone from the records office should have sat down with Mr. Townsend, given him what's known as Form I, which would have given him the information that there was a detainer, who the detainer was from, how he could resolve the detainer, and the forms to fill out to do that.
And that was who? The Illinois authorities?
Illinois authorities were supposed to do that, yes.
And they didn't do that?
The trial court found that they either did not do that or that the state could not meet its burden of showing they did not do that. It's not clear which they're actually finding. But the bottom line is there is no Form I in his prison file. And the testimony out of Hill Correctional is there should have been the form filled out. It should have been placed in his prison file. It's not there. As a matter of fact, subsequent to that, there is a note in the file in September of 23rd of 2001 that indicates that someone from Hill Correctional at that point has talked to Detective Olson in Milwaukee, and that note begins, due to the interstate agreement on detainers not being completed, which suggests that, in fact, Hill Correctional never followed through and did what they were supposed to do.
Well, if they didn't see Wisconsin argues, well, we're not at fault. There's no requirement. So why does this change things? Why does it make a difference?
Well, it makes a difference because the bottom line here is that this is a statute that everybody's entering into in order to do two things. One is to try and get some sort of orderly disposition of charges, and the other piece is intended to protect prisoners as well as all of the states. What is supposed to happen is that if we know what charges are out there, the underlying idea here is that, unfortunately, many times states lodge detainers which they never follow through on. So if you're a prison system putting somebody in a particular classification because you're expecting that he's got other charges, you don't follow through with some of the programs. In this case, for example, Mr. Townsend's prison status was different in Illinois than it would have been if there were no Wisconsin charge.
Would the prison status have remained where it was had Mr. Townsend been convicted of armed robbery?
I have no idea. It doesn't say so in the record. As near as I can tell, no one thought to ask Illinois that question down below, and I just don't know the answer to that.
Was Mr. Townsend ever testifying in all of this?
Yes, he did testify.
And did he testify that he was never notified?
He testified that he was never told that he was aware from the Cook County that there was a charge out there. He, in fact, as I recall, admitted that he knew it was from Wisconsin. From which jurisdiction, he apparently did not know. He testified to not knowing exactly what the charge was at that point. So did he know that there was some Wisconsin charge out there somewhere? Yes, I think it's fair to say from his testimony he did. Did he know exactly what was going on in Wisconsin or that there had been a detainer lodged? No, he did not.
Well, if we're to decide this matter on basically a policy approach, is there not some obligation on Mr. Townsend, knowing that there's a charge out there in Wisconsin, to make some inquiry?
Well, he apparently, I don't know whether he made the inquiry or whether there was a discussion. The summer before he's released from prison, there is a notation in the prison file that there was a discussion of a Wisconsin charge and he was given the wrong address. He's given the sheriff's address.
The
sheriff in Milwaukee, who is not who he would have needed to notify to invoke the interstate detainer. So he may very well have made some inquiry and been given the wrong information. That, unfortunately, he did not particularly recall that conversation. He did not deny it occurred. He just simply did not recall what had been said in that conversation, as I recall the record. There had been quite a bit of time that had passed. There were quite a bit of notations of discussion, various discussions with social workers over time. Unfortunately, because of the state of the Illinois prison system's records, there are a lot of things here that are not completely clear.
Was there any additional follow-up by the state of Wisconsin? You indicated that the detainer was lodged sometime between October 4th and October 7th of 1999. As I recall, he was released, maybe paroled, maybe around October of 2001. I might be off a month or two, but it was autumn of 2001.
Correct.
Is there any indication in the record that Wisconsin did any follow-up on their detainer request, lodged detainer?
What Wisconsin appears to have done, based on the testimony, is wait until the end of September of 2001. Then we know that there was some contact between Hill Correctional and Detective Olson in Milwaukee, where they were trying to figure out how to pick him up at that point once he was going to be released.
Anything within that two-year period then from the beginning of October until sometime in September, October 1999 to September 2001?
Not that I'm aware of. And, in fact, there is a procedure that could have been used that Wisconsin did not use. Now, I'm not arguing that they were absolutely obligated to use that procedure. What I'm saying is this, that had this been important, deeply important to Wisconsin, they could have gotten him up there. They could have gotten him up there through Article 4 of the Interstate Agreement on Detainer. It is a slightly different procedure. It has slightly different deadlines. It does not, in fact, require Mr. Townsend to agree or do anything. It puts the power straight into Wisconsin's hands. Wisconsin did not use that procedure.
Ms. Hennick, you were talking about prejudice. You mentioned the status, but you never finished.
I'm sorry?
The other prejudice that Mr. Townsend faced, you started to talk about that. You raised the issue that his status would have been different, but you didn't finish your argument with respect to the other prejudice as a result of him not being
okay. There are really two types of prejudice here. One is what happens within the Illinois prison system, where, in fact, he's classified as higher risk. And one of the things we do know, and that is clear in the Illinois records, is that his risk was raised because of the Wisconsin charge. What we also know is that was based on a paper review where he was not present, so he did not necessarily know that that was the reason. But that was the reason that Illinois raised his clearance status. The other possible prejudice is, had he been up here, there is a chance that he could have argued for a concurrent sentence. Now, whether he would have gotten a concurrent sentence, obviously, is somewhat speculative. But certainly he loses the possibility of a concurrent sentence.
The reason I ask the question is assuming that your client hasn't subsequently lost his right to appeal in this matter, and I have some questions about the flight risk issue, because it would seem to me, although there may be nothing in the record to verify that this person is convicted in Wisconsin of armed robbery, I wouldn't suspect that in Wisconsin, I wouldn't suspect his risk category to be lessened when he gets in Illinois as a result. So it would seem to me that the real prejudice we're talking about here is the right to concurrent sentencing. And that really, and I asked the question because I think it goes to the question of remedy and whether or not, assuming the court finds a violation of the Interstate Act for detainers, and assuming the court feels that there's a need to provide a remedy that is not provided for by statute, I'm not sure dismissal is the appropriate remedy. It would seem to me that perhaps we should be looking at a credit issue, that perhaps, since the real prejudice is that the inability to get concurrent sentencing, that perhaps the credit with respect to the new conviction, the armed robbery conviction, should date back to the date of the interstate detainer and when it was lodged. That would keep in place a valid Wisconsin conviction that we now know that the state has said he is guilty of, keep his record intact, give him the benefit of the prejudice that he had suffered. I see that to be a more reasonable way of approaching that than to say we dismiss the charges outright.
The problem that you're going to have with that remedy is that under your case law on sentence credit, you encounter a problem. Under the case law on sentence credit, once he's serving another sentence, you can't give him credit. So under the current state of the law, because he's serving an Illinois sentence, he's not being held on the Wisconsin case, and sentence credit isn't available. So whatever theoretically might be helpful, it's not available here. As a matter of fact, there really is
currently not available here.
Under the current state of the law, it's not available here. I suppose the court could ask us to brief whether that's possible or not possible. And in fact, I am aware that there are some cases brewing down in the Court of Appeals that have to do with how some of this interacts, but they're not at this court at this point.
Under this statute, under the detainer statute, these other cases coming up?
They're not. My understanding of those cases, and I'll be honest, one of them is mine, is that they're not technically under the detainer statute. They have to do with what the interaction is with cases in other states and our sentence credit law.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're not strictly detainer cases, but although some of them may have detainers involved. I'm not sure.
Well, did the judge here consider imposing the sentence and withholding it, so in consideration of having been in Illinois?
As I recall the sentencing transcript, and I have not gone over it really, really closely, I've reviewed it for this, but it was not the main thrust of what I was trying to remember. There really was no discussion of the time he had spent in Illinois at the point of sentencing. So I really have no idea what the sentencing judge was thinking in terms of that. I don't recall it being expressed in the record. I may be wrong on that because I wasn't specifically looking for it.
Well, following up on the train of what I think is Justice Butler's thought about not overturning a conviction when you find somebody that was guilty of an offense here, and that your real remedy is you don't like the sentencing. I mean, that's your real gripe.
Well, I don't think that is the real gripe. And the reason that I don't is because I'm looking at the underlying purposes of the statute. And there are two things going on here, I believe. One is what this does vis-a-vis Mr. Townsend. Mm-hmm. The other is the idea that you want to encourage all of the parties to this agreement to follow through. And if you say that the remedy should be that you deal in sentence credit, I think what you get is I think you're going to have trouble getting other states to follow that. I think what the statute itself seems to think in terms of
is... Do you think other states are going to follow overturning convictions?
I would like... There certainly are a couple of states that have suggested that the remedy is that you dismiss it. Colorado, for example, has done that in People v. Lincoln, has suggested that the remedy is that you dismiss it for failure to have your time limits. And certainly, if Mr. Townsend had been notified and Wisconsin had simply not gotten him to trial within a sufficient amount of time, it would have been dismissal because that's clearly in the statute.
That's right.
So it's not that the statute itself doesn't contemplate dismissal may be the remedy for failing to follow the statute.
No, but the statute is silent here on a violation here.
Correct. But the only sanctions that are given within that statute for any failure happens to be dismissal, which suggests that what everyone was looking at when they signed on to it and agreed to it and perhaps drafted it was that if you don't follow this, we're going to dismiss cases. That was the sanction that they saw as being appropriate for failing to follow the statute.
Counselor, if that's the sanction, wouldn't that discourage states from entering into the IAD? Because even though Wisconsin did everything that it was lawfully obligated to do, the state of Illinois did something that you are suggesting should result in Wisconsin having to dismiss charges of a crime that was committed in Wisconsin. And I don't see how that encourages people to then enter into these agreements when things that will cause dismissals are totally out of the state's control.
But that's already a part of the statute to some extent, because if Illinois had not messed up in a major way, but had simply given him the wrong form or sent the form. There are two places the form's supposed to go after it's filled out. Let's say it had only sent them to the court and not also to the DA's office. What you'd be into is the area where everybody seems to agree that you would have substantial compliance by Mr. Townsend. And if there was not follow-through at that point, that error does, in fact, end up charged to Wisconsin. Wisconsin can't turn around and say, oh, but we didn't get proper notification after they've not tried the case quickly enough and there would be dismissal. So to some extent, that already exists in the statute. There already is the situation in which one state may lose a case based on the actions or lack of action of another. So that's not – so if it was going to discourage everybody, it should have discouraged everybody already.
Is it your position that the state of Wisconsin is blameworthy because it didn't follow through, that it should have had a tickler system and that within X number of weeks, months, that it didn't hear from this prisoner, it should have followed through and said, Illinois, what's happening?
I don't believe that Wisconsin is a totally innocent victim. I think that there's sort of a continuation of blameworthiness. Did Wisconsin make a mistake under the statute? No, I'll concede that Wisconsin did not make a mistake under the statute. Could Wisconsin have avoided this with a tickler system and a follow-up? Absolutely, they could have done that.
But there's nothing in the statute that so requires it.
They're not required to do that. Could they have avoided this? Oh, there's no question in my mind that they could have avoided it and that they sort of lost it somewhere in the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office as well for a period of time.
You argue that there's no real remedy available other than dismissal. Your opposing counsel advances a few possibilities. And one is a 1983 action. I think another is a habeas. Can you address that argument?
Well, 1983 has a couple of hitches in it, technical hitches, that make it very difficult. There's going to be an immunity defense here because you've got state officials and you're going to have problems with absolute immunity for some of the parties, like the Department of Corrections, like the prisons. What he's going to have to do in order to get around that is probably to find various Illinois state officials, but even they may be able to give qualified immunity. One of the problems here, though, and I'm sorry, I see my time is up.
You may finish answering the question.
One of the problems here, though, is that how do you identify who exactly failed when Illinois can't seem to identify who was responsible for doing it? And that's why 1983 remedy won't work here, because you've got an absolute failure and you don't have anybody you can figure out was the person who was supposed to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll now hear from William Gansner, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Gansner.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General William Gansner, representing the state in this matter. There were a number of questions that the court raised during Ms. Hennick's argument that I think are extremely important for, they focused, I believe, on the correct matters here, and I want to address those. I also want to just begin by attempting to place this case in the context that I think we need to understand it arises in. Mr. Townsend committed an armed robbery, of which he is unquestionably guilty. He raises no challenge to his conviction, to the fact that he is guilty. He was convicted at a court trial on stipulated facts, and he has never raised a challenge to the legality or the sufficiency of the evidence sustaining his conviction. His claim is solely that he should never have been tried. He should never have been produced for a trial in Wisconsin. The charge should have been dismissed. What we are dealing with, of course, is a question of the delay claimed by Mr. Townsend in his coming back to Wisconsin. It's an opportunistic argument that arises out of a set of undisputed facts. Mr. Townsend committed an armed robbery in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee County. He then fled the state. We know that he fled because a month later, the Wisconsin police, the authorities in Milwaukee County, were advised by the police in Des Plaines, Illinois, that Mr. Townsend was in Illinois custody because he had been arrested for committing another armed robbery in Cook County. That began the process moving that results in us being here today. The state of Wisconsin, as we know, commenced an extradition request to have Mr. Townsend brought back. That was proper, lawful, and customary. The next thing that happened was the governor of Wisconsin issued a requisition warrant to the governor of Illinois saying, please issue a warrant to have him returned to Wisconsin. The governor of Illinois issued such a governor's warrant, stating that he is to be returned, but pursuant to Illinois practice, and a practice that is consistent with the text of the Extradition Act itself, 976.03, subsection 19, he was not returned to Wisconsin under the Illinois governor's extradition warrant because the statute authorizes a state, the asylum state or the sending state, to continue to hold that individual even in the face of Wisconsin's request that he be returned, if there is a pending criminal prosecution against the individual in Illinois. And it authorizes the asylum state or the sending state here, Illinois, to hold him until he is tried and discharged, if found not guilty, or convicted and punished. That is what the statute provides. Illinois' procedure that Ms. Hennick has referred to as the extradition warrant was simply not executed under what has been referred to as the Cook County Circuit Court procedure, that the extradition warrant simply isn't executed under those circumstances. I rather suspect that the Illinois governor's warrant contains language similar to what is contained, and admittedly this is outside the record, but when the governor of Wisconsin issues a requisition warrant saying that somebody who is in our custody should be returned to another state where charges are pending, the language of the warrant says the person is to be taken into custody and returned to that state unless there are charges pending here. That is a recognition of what 976.03 subsection 19 says, that the asylum state has precedence, has priority in the maintenance. It's kind of like possession is 9/10 of the law. We've got the guy here. We get to go first. When we're done with the charges against him, then they can go back. Okay. And that, of course, is why the initial extradition request, which was entirely proper for Wisconsin to start, wasn't executed. Your Honor?
In reading the majority and the dissent opinion, it seems like the tension in part between those two opinions is one of the dissent saying, hey, look, if there's a right, there should be a remedy. There was prejudice here, and the dissent asserts two areas of prejudice. One, the security ranking that he had in Illinois. Two, prejudice with regard to a concurrent sentence. And, you know, the majority doesn't think there was any wrong here, doesn't see any prejudice, and there's no remedy if there's no prejudice. Respond, if you will, to the idea that if there is a violation, and if there, hypothetical, and I guess the violation isn't hypothetical, if there's a violation, and if there is prejudice, and if there is prejudice, I said, no remedy. That just seems to be antithetical, you know. For every right, there's a wrong, and for every wrong, there's a right. And how do you explain that situation?
Reminiscent of the common law school class on Marbury versus Madison. Something wrong happened here, and there ought to be a remedy.
That's right. You know.
Doesn't the Wisconsin's Constitution say that?
Right. Article 1, Section 9. So let's go with that.
Wisconsin Constitution as well, of course. Which perhaps should be better taught in law school classes than it is.
So there's no remedy, assuming the wrong here.
Sure. We've attempted to address this in our brief, and here's what our position is. We think that it is not clear that there was any genuine prejudice sustained by the defendant here. First of all, with respect to the effect of the outstanding Wisconsin charges against the defendant while he was in custody in Illinois, all that has been demonstrated here is that it had the effect of placing Mr. Townsend, as I understand it, in a moderate escape risk category.
Guess they were right.
I think so.
Maybe. I'm sorry.
Maybe.
Allegedly. Hypothetically.
The first thing that Mr. Townsend did after apparently committing a crime in Wisconsin was to flee to Illinois, where he was then arrested for committing a new crime. It is little wonder that he might have been considered a moderate escape risk, with or without the presence of the Wisconsin charge. But that seems to me to be a relatively minor event or occurrence.
I know from other cases that the security risk changes your availability for programming and rehabilitation.
That can certainly happen, and that's among the evaluations that are done when a person first arrives at an institution. And of course, it is the assignment of the security classification, which can have an impact. There's no evidence in this case, however. There was no evidence presented that the escape risk, the moderate escape risk status that Mr. Townsend was assigned, had any significant impact or had any impact at all. There's no demonstrable evidence presented in this case that it had any impact in terms of limiting what was available to him in prison. It's also to be remembered he didn't stay in the Illinois prison very long.
Does the record reflect, and my recollection is there is factual evidence that he was placed in this ranking, moderate security risk, because of the outstanding charge in Wisconsin.
That is my understanding, yeah. Now, precisely what that meant in terms of what disadvantage or loss of benefit, if any, that he sustained as a result of that label being placed upon him, the record is silent. That's why I say given an opportunity for Mr. Townsend to present in the circuit court at the second go-round of evidentiary hearings in this case, evidence that he actually sustained as a result of his classification in the Illinois prison system, some loss of benefits or loss of programming that he otherwise would have had. No such evidence really was presented.
I would like you to address, you know, there is a violation, assuming there is prejudice, and there may not be. What about your argument that there's no remedy, even if there is prejudice?
Okay.
Or no remedy of dismissal.
Sure. The state's position in this case is a simple one. It follows in a series of steps. The text of the statute itself does not provide the remedy that the defendant is seeking. I have suggested in my brief that this defendant is not asking this court to interpret the statute. Mr. Townsend is asking this court to amend the statute. This is a statute that very specifically provides in four instances for dismissal as a remedy for four specific failures to comply with mandatory portions of the statute, as passed by Congress and as passed by 46, 48 states, the legislatures of the federal government and the legislatures of the state have agreed that there are four specific circumstances. We've outlined them in our brief, and they're simple. If an individual asks for a trial after having been notified the charges are pending and he doesn't get it within 120 days, dismissal. If the state asks to bring him back and he is brought back by a request for temporary custody and there's no trial within 180 days, dismissed. If the anti-shuttling provisions of the statute are violated, that is, if the defendant is brought back, however he comes back to Wisconsin, if he's returned to the state where he was imprisoned without a trial having been completed, the charges are to be dismissed. Those specific dismissals are mandated by the statute for four specific circumstances. But there is no remedy in this very specific statute that specified remedies for specific failings. There is no remedy provided for a state prison system, as in this case apparently occurred, failing to notify the defendant that the detainer has been lodged, which is apparently what happened here.
Your answer to Justice Bradley is no remedy.
That the statute does not provide a remedy. That's correct.
Any remedy has to be outside the statute.
Yes.
Okay. Suppose that the defendant has an alibi witness for the Wisconsin armed robbery, and now his trial has been delayed for 5 years, and his alibi witnesses are gone, dead, not, whereabouts unknown. His defense is gone. That's prejudice, right?
Yes, and such remedy as may very well be available to this defendant would exist outside.
What remedy does he have outside of
the Act because of a due process claim of prejudicial pretrial delay, presumably.
Oh, so there is a remedy for prejudicial pretrial delay.
If there actually was prejudice sustained, then of course in this case Mr. Townsend has alleged no prejudice to his rights to a fair trial. He's raised no challenge to the fact of his conviction.
Okay. So Wisconsin wasn't at fault, according to you, right?
That's our number two position.
All right.
Can I ask you about
that? So you don't have fault in Wisconsin. You're wrong. Okay, you don't have fault on Wisconsin. You have nothing under the detainer statute. And so now Wisconsin tries him. At the first opportunity they can get their hands on him, right? Mm-hmm. And his defense is the delay has caused him to have no defense. So, because his witnesses are all gone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The delay has produced significant prejudice due to his ability to defend himself.
So what does he do? I mean, he says, well, I don't have a defense. My alibi witnesses are gone. I didn't take depositions. I don't have anything that they'll say. Wisconsin says, not my fault that you were in Illinois for whatever number of years.
states this. Now, Michael, we didn't delay. We didn't do anything wrong. The fact that you don't have a defense is not our fault. Mm-hmm. This guy could have died a day after the robbery, the alleged robbery. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what's his remedy? Anything?
His remedy, if any, would come by an application of the standard analysis that is applied to any case of a defendant outside of the application of the Detainer Act. Any case where a defendant contends that delay in bringing him to trial causes prejudice. And that would include an assessment of the severity of the length of the delay, the severity of the prejudice.
Even if it's not the state's fault of the delay?
Under the existing framework for analyzing these claims, there's an analysis of who is responsible for the delay that looks at both the state's role, if any, and the defendant's role or the role of other outside forces or agencies. So that's a claim that could be considered in any case, regardless of whether or not the Detainer Act were ever involved. Two different states were involved. And Mr. Townsend, had he believed that there was any basis for making a claim that the delay in his trial in Wisconsin had caused prejudice to his fair trial rights, had in any way disadvantaged his opportunity to defend himself, surely could be counted upon to have made that claim, and he didn't. There is no such claim in this case. He's conceded that there is no such claim. But the question that I've taken a way too long a roundabout to get around to answering is, I think, Justice Bradley's question, and also I want to address, I think, the question that Justice Butler raised during Ms. Hennick's argument, which is, if we could wrap our minds around the idea that there was any loss, any disadvantage, any loss of benefit to this individual here from the delay, that it might be the inability to seek a concurrent sentence or a delay in obtaining a concurrent sentence. And I want to say two things about that. One, the sentence that was imposed in Wisconsin was concurrent. That is to say, if you look at the judgment of conviction in this case, which appears in the appendix to Ms. Hennick's brief, it does not say whether the sentence is concurrent or consecutive. Under well-established Wisconsin law, a judgment of conviction that does not specify that it is concurrent or consecutive is concurrent. At such time as sentence was imposed in Wisconsin, it appears, and I know of nothing to the contrary, that Mr. Townsend was still at least on paper under the Illinois sentence. He had had an 8-year sentence, as I understand it, imposed in Illinois, and a 9-year sentence was imposed here.
How much time, though, did he spend in Illinois? My recollection is it's about 4 years in the prison system. He got out in October of 2001, and his charge emanates from...
He was actually sentenced in Illinois in February of 1999 to an 8-year prison term. Mm-hmm. He was released and was back in Wisconsin in October of 2001. So a little bit more than 2 years. Two and a half years.
Yeah,
Illinois.
It was 4 years from the first contact in 97.
From the first. And presumably, although the record isn't perfectly clear, he got credit against his Illinois sentence for the period of time he was in custody awaiting trial in Illinois. I would assume that Illinois, I do not know this as a fact, but I assume that Illinois has a similar provision as we do that grants sentence credit. But an 8-year sentence total was imposed in 1999, and even if there's as much as 2 years credit on it, there were still 6 years remaining. He gets released in 2001. Once he's convicted in Wisconsin, the 9-year sentence that was imposed here was imposed because there's no ruling that it is to be consecutive. It is presumed to be concurrent, and I would point out that the sentencing transcript in this case, and Ms. Hennick, I think, indicated that perhaps it had been a while since you looked at it. I've looked at it recently and often. There is no mention whatsoever in the argument by defense counsel in the case that the sentence imposed in Wisconsin should in any way take into account the period of time he was incarcerated in Illinois. Surprisingly, I would have thought the defense counsel would have said, Your Honor, you ought to take into account the fact that he's been waiting in Illinois for some time before coming up here. The court had gone through a long evidentiary hearing dealing with the motion to dismiss for under the Detainer Act, but there was no request whatsoever that the court take that into account.
I want to know whether, since you've emphasized that it's concurrent, how many years does he have to serve in Wisconsin when he has already served, the way I get it, at least 3.5 to 4 years in Illinois, if he's been given credit? Or even if it's 2.5, does he have 9 years minus 2.5 in Wisconsin? Is that what you're telling me?
Ms. Hennig began her comments this morning referring to information that I provided her this morning that I became aware of only today about Mr. Townsend being an absconder. And the reason I know that, or have reason to believe that, is that in order to be able to answer this court's question as to how much time he has left on his Wisconsin sentence, I consulted the online records this morning before coming here of the Department of Corrections and found that he has a maximum discharge date of September 30 of 2010. So he still has time remaining.
Yeah,
that same document said, oops, he's an absconder.
But my question is, when you figure the 9 years, are you giving him credit for the term he served in Illinois if it's concurrent? That's the question.
You want me to do the math?
I just want to know the answer, yes or no. I don't want to know the time.
Could he receive?
I want to know whether, if it's concurrent, and usually a sentence is concurrent, but I don't know that usually a sentence is concurrent to another state's sentence. I mean, if it was Wisconsin's sentence, I would understand that. We're dealing with another state. I don't know the rule as to whether it's concurrent to another state, and I want to know whether it's concurrent or not, because in paragraph 22 of Judge Curley's dissent, she says, first, as the earlier opinion notes, he was classified as a moderate escape risk as a result of outstanding Wisconsin charge. So it seems as if there's something in this record upon which the Court of Appeals based its first opinion that he was prejudiced in Illinois, or at least he was, as a result of the outstanding Wisconsin charge, classified upwards. Then she goes on to say, more importantly, he was prejudiced by the fact that his trial for the Wisconsin charge was delayed for 5 years. If he had received the identical sentence in an earlier trial, he would have already served 5 years of the 9-year sentence. I just want to know if she's right or wrong.
Well, respectfully, I believe that Judge Curley has overstated the matter.
Okay.
Because the math that's involved here seems to be this. Judge Curley appears to be saying that if Mr. Townsend had been tried in Wisconsin in the same year in which he committed the crime and had then been sentenced to 9 years in prison, then by 2002 he would have served 5 years. Well, number one, it's unlikely that any individual is going to be tried within a very brief period of time after a charge is brought, absent a plea. But moreover, let's take into account the very real-world fact that this defendant contributed to that 5-year delay by fleeing the state and then going to another state where he was arrested and convicted for a crime. So I don't think it's right. I don't think it's accurate for us to say if he had been convicted in 1997, the same year in which he was charged, and then fled and got himself involved in another case in Illinois, and if a 9-year sentence had been imposed then, he'd have already served 5 years of it, because I think it's extremely unlikely that he would have been tried and sentenced in the same year in which he had been, in which the offense had been committed.
Mr. Gassner, I think the 97 may be throwing things off here. As I understand the facts of this case, the detainer that was lodged somewhere between October 4th and October 7th of 99.
Yes.
So it would seem to me that with respect to any issue regarding whether or not there's concurrent credit, we would be looking from the lodging of the date of the detainer.
Except I think Judge Curley was looking at 1997 because she was saying he was sentenced in 2002. He should have been sentenced 5 years earlier. I'm sorry.
No, I understand. And I think that's a misnomer. I think that maybe was throwing things off. Right. But I want to focus on the date of the detainer.
Yep.
And ask the question, because as I understand the major claim for prejudice, I know that the defense is arguing two, but as I understand the major claim, it's the inability to have concurrent sentencing. You've already pointed out that the sentence is concurrent. We know that there was a detainer lodged by Wisconsin in 1999 that was not served on this particular defendant.
Due to no fault of Wisconsin, but Illinois.
Well, I want to ask you about the fault question because that presents a separate problem. But the first question is if we're looking at credit issues, if we were to look at this as a straight credit question, we know he's got this detainer here. We know he is technically, arguably, sitting on that detainer. He's got a concurrent sentence. Why should he not receive credit for the time spent in custody as of the date of the detainer as a remedy for what is a violation of the Interstate Act of Detainers? And as part of the question, I don't think it's that one can say that Wisconsin is blameless here because the whole point of the Detainer Act is that all the states are buying into it. They're all signing on. They're all agreeing to be a part of this act. So to the extent that the act is to be followed by all, I think that all of the states have to be bound by what occurred in it. So to the extent that you have a violation here, should we be looking at this as a credit question, as a means of creating a remedy that really deals with the prejudice and not looking at getting rid of a conviction? Or should we just say, well, too bad, so sad, which is what I thought your brief was pretty much stressing.
Okay. That's the question you asked Ms. Hennig.
Exactly.
And I started off by saying, I need to answer that question. Thank you for throwing out the grappling hook and getting me back to it.
Go.
And Justice Bradley attempted as well. I apologize for taking so long to get to it. Here's the point, and here's our best answer to this. Our position is the remedy that Ms. Hennig and Mr. Townsend have asked for in this case is grossly disproportionate. Number one, it's not provided for by the statute. There's no question. It would be an amendment of the statute, in our view, not simply a simple interpretation of the statute, to provide a remedy of dismissal. And it would be grossly unfair and disproportionate to any disadvantage or prejudice that the defendant has sustained. It would be unfair to the people of Wisconsin that a conviction that was clearly appropriate be thrown out because of the delay, because of the violation of Illinois. If there was a remedy appropriate here, if there was a prejudice in this case, it is appropriate, I think, for the court to focus on the question of sentence and sentence credit. Consideration by this court of the appropriateness of granting some relief to a defendant based in a circumstance such as this, where there has been delay by another state in returning him to Wisconsin, seems to me if we focus on the possibility of circuit court granting sentence credit against the Wisconsin sentence, that's certainly a much more appropriate remedy to consider than the grossly disproportionate remedy of throwing out the conviction. If the defendant has been affected in any way by the delay here, it may be, and it seems to me it is only in the realm of sentencing, and whether or not the period of time he was in Illinois should have been shorter and his Wisconsin sentence could have started earlier. That kind of remedy would do no damage to the text of this act. To grant the remedy of prejudice that the defendant has asked for in this case would be, as I've said, to amend the statute to provide something that most states asked to look at it have rejected, and might even raise a question as to whether or not it is, in fact, effectively an amendment of the statute that raises a question as to whether, let's remember, this is a federal statute as well, which the United States Supreme Court interpreted in Fex versus Michigan, and a ruling to this effect might very well raise a question as to whether or not might very well raise a federal statutory question as to whether it's appropriate to do it all, to order dismissal. But if we look at the question of sentence, it seems to me that that is a certainly far more appropriate way to look at this matter. And I want to point out, this defendant could have asked, it seems to me, for that consideration in the circuit court at the time of sentencing. I've gone through the sentencing transcript, which is 30 or 40 pages, and there is the customary argument for both sides. A pre-sentence had recommended 5 years. The defense asked for 5 years. The state asked for 15. Looking at the defendant's record, prior offenses in the state of New York, then the Wisconsin armed robbery, and then the Illinois armed robbery, the judge ordered 9 years with 326 days of sentence credit for the period of time he was in jail in Milwaukee after his return from Illinois on the ultimate waiver of extradition, and from that time until the date of sentencing. But there was no consideration and no argument by anyone, most importantly by defense counsel, that the period of time that Mr. Townsend was in prison in Illinois should be taken into account by the court in sentencing.
Was there any argument about concurrent or consecutive? As I heard you,
no,
there was none.
No, there was,
okay,
there was
thank
none.
You.
There was none. There was a reference by defense counsel who said, well, effectively, he served his sentence in Illinois. I don't think that was really accurate, because I think that there was at least some time remaining on the Illinois sentence, given the fact that it was 8 years long, even with the credit that may have been given for pretrial incarceration in Cook County. And it may be that's why defense counsel didn't argue about granting credit or making the sentence concurrent, because he apparently was of the view that the Illinois sentence was over. I think that's wrong. But in any event, that was an occasion for defense counsel to have raised, I think, an argument. He'd already lost his motion to have the charge entirely thrown out, dismissed, because of Illinois' violation of the Detainer Act.
So you are arguing
that was an occasion in which the matter could have been raised, and I think our view on this is I'm not ready to concede that that's what this court should argue, should hold. I recognize that it's within this court's power, I believe, to, in this kind of case, fashion that kind of remedy. And what I will say is that is clearly a more appropriate remedy than dismissal, because it is not disproportionate to the claimed prejudice.
Mr. Gansner, the announcement that was made at the beginning of the argument,
yes,
I don't prejudge this in any way, shape, or form, but can you suggest how this will be followed up? How is the court going to?
If I can just speak about how this matter came up, I consulted the Department of Correction website this morning simply for the purpose of finding out what the discharge date for Mr. Townsend was, so that if that issue came up, how much time is remaining, I could address it. On the face of the page that describes his current situation or that describes his past custody, shows that he was released on parole on from Wisconsin on September 28, 2005, shows his discharge date out in 2010, but then, to my surprise, and I had never seen this before, was completely unaware of it, status abscond. I can advise the court, I contacted very quickly, made a telephone call to the probation and parole office in Milwaukee. His particular agent was not available, but I implored another agent to check their records, who told me that a violation warrant for Mr. Townsend had been issued last May. I was completely unaware of this. I have no doubt that Ms. Hennick was as well. That's why I brought it to her attention. I have copies of what I have produced from the court's website.
Well, what's the follow-up?
Which I'll be glad to share with the court. But what to make of it? Ms. Hennick has fairly asked that she and I ought to be able to confirm that these facts are accurate so that we can tell the court what the actual facts are.
All right.
And then I think the question is, what effect does it have? There is established precedent in this state that suggests that an escape by a prisoner pending post-conviction motion or appeal constitutes a forfeiture of the right to appeal or to pursue the post-conviction motion. The question remains whether in the exercise of discretion a court could maintain the case. But there is established precedent in this state
that
it's a forfeiture of the right to appeal.
Even when absconding from parole?
It's escape.
Okay.
Yeah.
Under the statute?
The specific case law that exists in Wisconsin is not for a person who has absconded, which is a form of escape from supervision. That is correct. So that's a matter that would have to be argued to the court.
That's what I'm asking.
And I must tell you, for my part, I apologize to the court for not having known this. I have not had a case like this before, and I was checking simply to find out whether or not what Mr. We knew that Mr. Townsend had been paroled. We knew that because of the last hearing in the circuit court. He said he was about to be paroled. But the fact that he had become an absconder from parole supervision was news to both myself and Ms. Henning.
Okay, how many days before you advised the court about the facts, Mr. Ganster? Ms. Henning?
I'd have to talk with Ms. Henning, but I suspect we have every reason to do so quickly, and I certainly think we'd be able to do it within a week or less. I don't see any reason why we wouldn't be able to know what the facts are very quickly.
All right. Well, you may be seated, Mr. Gainsner. Ms. Hennick, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. You can start with this issue.
All right. What I would suggest that we do is I think that there are two pieces to this. And the first one, obviously, is to verify the information. And the second is I'm aware of the case law that talks about escape as well. I'm not entirely sure how it applies to absconding. What I would suggest is that we confirm it and do quick letter briefs to the court. I would ask for 2 weeks because it requires both the research and the getting the information together. And I don't, quite frankly, I don't think I can get both of them together within the next week. I think I need 2 weeks. So
thank
that
you.
Would be my suggestion.
Ms. Hennick, now you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Okay.
And the court will advise you, Justice Presser.
I just don't quite understand the argument about the concurrent sentence. Could you please explain your view on that?
All right. I think that one of the things that's confused here is that we all tend to think of concurrent sentences, they run entirely together. But the truth is, even in Wisconsin, if you have two sentences and they're consecutive, you serve the prison parts first, and then we deal with what's parole. So, in this case, had he been sentenced to a concurrent sentence, let's say in 1999 or 2000, when the detainer is lodged, if he were sentenced, 1999, I'm sorry, when the detainer was lodged, and we had made the sentences concurrent then, what would have happened is he would have gotten credit against his Wisconsin sentence for the time he was serving in Illinois because he would have been serving both sentences. Because he was given a sentence after he had served the Illinois time, even though technically those sentences were concurrent, he doesn't end up serving any of the time at the same time. Illinois may allow its parole to continue running. I have no idea whether they did or didn't. There's nothing in the record. They could very well have, and that would have been appropriate given that they were concurrent. But the truth is, no matter how you consider this sentence, he ends up serving more time than he would have had he been given that sentence earlier.
Counselor, doesn't your argument presuppose that when the court looks at someone convicted of armed robbery and they're in an Illinois prison, that he is going to give the same sentence, regardless of whether he was in prison or whether he was just in Wisconsin for sentencing?
Well, this is where this one a little bit tricky to figure. We know that the judge gave technically concurrent time. What we don't know is whether he did that. There's no discussion of it. So he may have been figuring, serve that first, serve this second, and he might have done something different earlier on. What we know is what he did. He gave concurrent time. And had he given that concurrent time earlier, there would have been an effect on how much time was actually spent in prison. That's what we can know at this stage.
Concurrent time, he gets 3 years in prison and 5 on parole, and then he gets a concurrent sentence while he if they all are at the same time, you would serve, first you serve the time of both, and then you start parole of each one of them.
Correct.
So it's not like you serve the time, you get out, you finish your parole, they put you back in. It's not like that.
Exactly.
And so the point is, had he been sentenced while he was in Illinois, then he would have been given Wisconsin credit. Now the only way of doing it is in some form of a credit, because he's no longer in prison in Illinois, and he wasn't when he was sentenced in Wisconsin. So concurrent sentences don't mean anything.
Exactly. The truth is, whether it's concurrent or consecutive, at this point, he's going to serve all of the time given in Wisconsin.
Right. Because he's already served his Illinois prison term.
Correct.
No way of getting back, except as Justice Butler started this conversation, of how somehow a sentence credit, which you say is not authorized under the statute, so it's a way of recalculating it in terms of discretionary sentence.
I'm not arguing that it's not authorized under the Interstate Detainer Act.
No,
that's silent. I'm not sure that sentence credit law in Wisconsin
would justify it.
I
understand.
But neither of the parties have briefed that, at least not in this case.
So what do you think about sending this back, remanding this, assuming the court continues, remanding this to the circuit court to reconsider its sentence, as if it was giving it when he was serving time in Illinois, and did he really intend it concurrent to the Illinois time? Therefore, what the result might be 9 years, the same as this, or the result might be 3 years because he would have given some credit. Pardon, the credit is in quotes.
I would not be opposed to the court doing something like that. Clearly, I'm arguing that the remedy is dismissal.
I understand.
I believe that there needs to be a remedy for this. If this court is not going to consider dismissal as the remedy, I still believe that there needs to be some sort of a remedy here. I see that my time is up, so I would just ask that the court clarify what we're doing as to the absconding, so that I think Mr. Ganser and I both know exactly what we're supposed to do at this point.
I'm sure I have confidence that you will get a letter from the court saying you have 2 weeks from date. First advise us what the facts are, then brief what consequences are of those facts.
I appreciate that. As mail to Milwaukee sometimes takes several days.
We'll send it to you by email, counsel. Both of you.
And I'll fax my email copy immediately to Ms. Henry.
Well, is there anything else on this case to come before the court? I want to thank both counsel for arguing another detainer case. We have had two during this year. And also their ability to handle new facts as they come up. Not supposed to happen on appeal with new facts. That concludes our hearing of 2003 AP 429 CR State versus Townsend. Thank you, counsel. And the court will take a few moments in recess for those students who wish to leave. They may do so. The students and others who wish will meet with Justice Butler after the second oral argument. We are in recess.